Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Cariad Lloyd. Griefcast is a place to talk, share and laugh about the peculiar human process of death and grief. Each week, I talk to a different person about their experiences of grief and death as we remember someone that they have lost along the way, whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club. Welcome to Griefcast.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Hey, Griefsters. I hope you're having an okay week. Thank you so much for all your beautiful messages so far about the new series. It means so much to me. So thank you so much. I'm so glad that you've been enjoying it and enjoying the new guests that we've had on. I have mentioned it before, but just to let you know, I've written a book. It is out next year. It is called You Are Not Alone, and you can pre-order it now. Why should we pre-order it, Cariad? Well, let me tell you, Griefster, because pre-orders really help authors. Basically, if lots of people pre-order, it makes other people go, wow, gosh, a lot of people want this book. It must be good. So if you would like to pre-order it, I would be hugely, hugely grateful. I will tweet and Instagram the link in the usual places at The Griefcast. Thank you so much. This week, I'm talking to the incredible Kenny Ethan Jones. Kenny is a writer and an activist, a former model. He advocates on menstruation, body politics, mental health, and intimacy. He's an incredible, incredible person. If you follow him on Instagram, he's a huge following. You will know already what joy Kenny brings to the world. I had such a brilliant chat with Kenny, and it was really inspiring, actually. We have a lot of conversations at the Griefcast, and, you know, some of them are really difficult conversations, but I felt so lifted after talking to Kenny. The way he sees the world, the way he dealt with or is dealing with his grief is just, yeah, I enjoyed the conversation. I know enjoy is not quite the right word. We're always struggling with the language around grief, but I hope you enjoy it too. Kenny came in to talk to me about his mum and his dad. So, Kenny, who are we remembering today?
My mum.
Your mum.
Yes.
Oh, Kenny. And how long ago did your mum die?
God, approaching, I think it's 7 years now. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so quite a long time ago.
Well, I don't think seven's long.
No?
Because obviously I'm 20 plus since my dad died. So for me, I think seven's tricky. 0 to 5, people are still kind of there for you. They kind of remember it. 5 to 10, people kind of forget that that has happened.
I agree.
And like, if you bring it up, they're like, oh, right, yeah, that. And you're like, yeah, I'm still sad about it. So yeah, I think seven is hard. It's a hard number.
I agree, because I think in that sense, like I don't think I began to grieve till after year 5. So it's like I'm really quite fresh in it, although it happened a long time ago. Actually going through the motions of it properly didn't happen. Yeah, until 5 years after. So.
Oh yeah, definitely. So what happened? How did she die?
So the long story or the short story?
Whatever one you want to start with.
Okay.
Whatever one.
I'll paint the picture. So I was 21. I had just got offered a job as an international recruitment consultant in Prague, and yeah, fantastic job. I was at that point where I was like, I'm gonna build a career for myself. I was working in a shoe shop at the time. I just wanted something different. And I got offered this international job. And I was just like, I'm going to take it. So had a conversation with my mum about it. She started crying. You're leaving me. How dare you? I like, what am I going to do about you? And I was like, mum, like, I need to become a man. Like, I need to travel. Bless her. She was just like, I get it, but like, I'm going to miss you. And so we had this really like heartwarming moment where she was just like, I'm so proud of you. And so, yeah, I decided to take that job. I was there for about 2 months and we spoke every single day. This, do you know what? My mum is so old school. We spoke on Facebook. She didn't even text me or anything. Just like loads of voice notes from Facebook. And she made a habit out of calling me every evening just to see like how I was. And they were like 2 minute conversations sometimes. And yeah, it was just to be like, how are you? How's work? And I was just like, it's okay. It's weird. I'm eating different foods because I can't read it because it's not in English. So I don't know what I'm eating. Like I picked out, I think it was, what was it? Spoiled milk.
Because they sell that.
So I kept taking the milk home and being like, why is it spoiled? I bought it yesterday, realizing that I'm buying spoiled milk the whole time. So my mum was laughing about that. And then, yeah, I kept getting like things that were chicken, but they were steak and just really weird things. So basically that was my whole conversation with my mum being like, mum, I need food. I don't understand what's happening. And her being like, come back, I'll cook for you. I'm like, mum, it's not that easy. I can't come back. So yeah, that's what was happening. And my mum was always quite sick as a person. Like she just, her health was already up and down. She had cancer when I was 15 and they always kind of said her health is going to be up and down. And so when I left, I asked my friends, could they come to the house and just check in on her and see how she is? And in the beginning, in the first like 2 months, everyone was like, you know, she seems fine. She's sad. She misses you, but she's okay. Mm. And because she had so many people coming and looking after her, I think that helped. And then obviously, as I spent more time there, people started to like visit her less frequently. Yeah. And so that started to happen. And I remember, you know, the calls, it got to a point where I was working 10, 12 hour days. Mm. And so I didn't speak to her as much. And so the conversations went from talking to her for 5 minutes on the phone to 2 minutes on the phone to voice notes that I didn't reply to. And we kind of just lost touch a little bit, but I was always thinking about her. And I remember one day she called and something was just different in her voice. Like I could just tell that something was wrong. And so the first thing I do, I call my friend. I say, hey, can you go check on my mum, please? See if she's okay. My friend comes to the house. She calls me back. She goes, I'm not sure. I'm not sure how she is. And I said, okay, like, what is it about her? She's like, she just seems a lot more messier. She was quite a neat person. And so to think that she was messy and things were out of place was quite just out of character for her. And she was like, she just doesn't seem as bubbly. She was such a bubbly person, like. And so she just like, she doesn't seem herself. And I said, okay, I'll try to keep more of an eye on her. So I was trying to make the time to call her. And I'd call her and sometimes she was sleeping at weird times. So she didn't answer the phone. So I'm getting all of these little flags. I'm like, I don't really know what to do with them. And there was this one particular morning that I woke up and the best way to describe it was a whole bodily feeling that said, go home. Just every fiber in my body said, go home. And I was like, I've never experienced that. I've never been so certain that I needed to do something in my entire life. Something just said, Kenny, pack a bag and go home. And I don't know, because of how strong the feeling was, I felt distressed and I didn't know what to do with it. And I was also like, is this normal? Like, does this happen to people?
Yeah.
But I know from other grief stories that sometimes it does happen. But obviously at the time I didn't know this. And I was like, what do I do with this? I said, I've got to go home. You know, I don't know what else to do. I have to go home. And at the time I had no money because working in Prague, you didn't earn, you know, the salary that you did here was a lot less. So booking a flight home was so expensive. So I called my friend frantically asking him to borrow me money so I could get on the first plane and come home. I think after hearing how distressed I was, he said, okay, sent me the money. I booked the flight. I went to my job. I quit there and then said, I'm going home.
Wow.
Yeah. I don't know. Something just literally, this happened. So this was the night before. And by the morning I had already booked my flight, gone into my job, given the key back to the office and said, I'm leaving. And booked my flight for later that evening. All of this happened in less like 24 hours.
Wow.
I go back. Yeah, so we're at the office now. I'm having like a couple of goodbye drinks with some of the people that I'm close with. This feeling in my body hasn't left.
Mm.
I go to the airport. There was an accident. And so I missed my flight.
Oh.
Like, that's the last thing I wanted to happen. Yeah. I was like, okay, I don't even know what to do about missing a flight because I've never really traveled. So it's like, how does this work? Do I get my money back? Because also I don't have enough money to book another flight.
You're just a baby at 21, aren't you? Like,
I don't know what was going on. Yeah. I just wanted to go home. And so anyways, they said, it's fine, we'll rebook your flight, but there isn't another one till the next morning. So I slept in the airport, calling my mum. She's kind of answering. I don't really know what's going on. I'm calling my sister. She's like, no, mum's fine. I'm like, no, mum isn't fine. Like, I don't know. Like, just trust my feeling. Like, mum isn't fine. Anyways, come home, walk through the door. My mum is like crying hysterically because she's so happy to see me. She's like, I missed you, my boy. Like, why are you here? Because I didn't even say really I was coming home. I just came back.
Yeah, yeah.
I was like, mum, I quit my job. She's like, why did you quit? And I was like, I don't know. I didn't want to make a big deal about why I was there. So I was just like, I'd come home. And I was just like, the job didn't work out for me. I wanted to be home. I missed like you. And she was like, okay, fine. And then it became apparent very quickly that she was unwell when I was there. Like, by the next day, she was clinging onto door frames while she was trying to walk through the house. And she was trying to hide it.
Yeah.
So she was just like leaning towards things. And I was just like, that's a bit out of character to do that.
Yeah.
And then I realized. And then the next day, my mum's best friend came to the house and said, I'm taking her to the hospital. And obviously at 21, those things, you don't really understand what's happening. You don't, you know, like, what do you do? You know, I trust my mum. She's the adult. So when I'm saying to her, you're okay. And she's going, I am. I believe her.
Yeah.
But she's because she hated hospitals. She absolutely hated hospitals. But so that was the last place she was going to allow anybody to take her. But obviously her best friend knew and was like, we need to go to the hospital.
Yeah.
So we went to the hospital. She's put in a wheelchair. She's cussing and swearing. She has a Liverpool accent. So she's cussing and swearing. It's a little strong Liverpool accent. It'd be like, why the fuck am I in this wheelchair? Like, I'm fine. And then they're asking her things. Like, you know, how old are you? Who's the prime minister? All of these things. And I'm not really understanding why.
Yeah.
And my mum's just sat there looking at the doctors going, do you think I'm stupid? Like, I'm fine. And she's convinced, I feel like, that she's fine. Said, okay. They said, we need to leave her in a hospital overnight. I said, okay. My sister decided to stay a little bit longer and talk to her. Anyways, 2 days later, she was comatized. She put in an induced coma.
Oh, my God.
No one's really explained what's happened. I just know that she's in the intensive care ward and that's basically all they've said.
Do you think she was holding it together for so long and then once you're in a hospital setting, it's like, you can't fake it anymore, can you? It's like people are looking at you going, we know. And then just everything just went, oh my God, bless her.
I agree. And it's like now on reflection, I could see. So this is quite detailed and graphic, but I remember she always forgot to like flush the toilet sometimes.
Mm.
And I remember looking in the toilet and thinking that she had cleaned the floor of the house and it wasn't. It was because her kidneys were failing and her pee had become so brown that I just didn't associate with BMP. So she knew she was ill. She just didn't want to. And after she had passed, I found she used to write on the back of envelopes things to remember. And she knew, like, it was a whole diagnosis of things of what she was unwell with. Basically it was multiple things, but essentially it was because of alcohol. So end of stage alcohol situation, really. And she was in the hospital. She went into the intensive care ward. They didn't explain what kind of state she was in, just that she was in an induced coma and that she needed to stay like that temporarily. And I think as well, where I was quite young, they didn't want to give me the details, so they were telling my older sister. And they were like, you can go and see her.
How much older is your sister? Is she...
good couple years. Right, like 14 years difference.
So you're getting that slight younger sibling where things fly past your head slightly and other people are talking and you're like, I guess someone will tell me when it really matters. Like,
Everyone's kind of pushing me to the side and I don't think in a way of being dismissive, but just...
yeah, protective,
like,
isn't it?
Exactly. Just trying to be like, let's keep as much away from Kenny as we can until necessary. But it became obvious when we walked into the intensive care ward how bad it was. So we open a door and they've got the double doors. Because they have the one door to come in and then you have a little waiting room section. And then there's another door when you go in. So we walk into, me and my sister walk into the first set of doors. The door closes. That door closes behind you and the other one opens. And I remember pushing the door open and seeing all of the machinery, all of these different tubes, a thing down her throat. And being like, how is it 2 days ago she was fine or somewhat fine and now she's here? And my sister is such an incredibly strong woman and she lost feeling in her legs and just completely dropped to the floor hysterically, like crying. And I'm trying to hold it together because I can see how hurt she is now. Mm. But I'm also witnessing the same thing and just in pure disbelief that this is where we're at right now.
Yeah.
And so I just stood there and like tried to be there for my sister and said, okay, well, this is where we're at. And I don't know why, but in that moment, there was this radical acceptance. Mm. It wasn't, I think I had all of those signs, and now this was, okay, she's really ill.
Yeah.
And you just have to accept that because this is where we're at. So that's what happened. And she stayed in the hospital in the intensive care ward for 4 weeks. She kind of came around in the third week. And, you know, I was going to the hospital every day. My sister was going to the hospital every day. They said to play music because she might respond to it. So he was playing her favorite tracks. I would talk to her every day. My sister would talk to her every day. Her family came down from Liverpool. All of my siblings on my dad's side came. My dad came to the hospital. And, you know, we had such a great support system, but it was becoming obvious that she wasn't getting any better.
Yeah.
And I think everyone was realising it, again, trying to protect me. Nobody wanted to say, but at this point, I'm like, I'm not stupid.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, 4 weeks had passed and it got to the point where they said, it's time to say goodbye, basically. Like, this is going to be it. We want to take all the tubes out. We've done what we can do. This is where we're at. And I just said, like, okay. They've tried. We've been here for 4 weeks now. Nothing else seems to be happening because she came around a little bit, but she could twiddle her toes and she could move her eyes, but she couldn't really talk because the tube was there. And even when they took the tube out, just not fully responsive. And, you know, I remember sitting at the end of the bed again and seeing the colour of her pee, be like, she's not getting better. They had her on kidney dialysis. There were so many different things that they had tried at this point, and I seen it. And I know, like, the nurses really did and the doctors really did try their best. And so, again, just a point of acceptance. This is where we are. All I can do at this moment is be here. And so they took all the tubes out. They took everything out. And they said, you know, she's probably going to pass away within the next, like, 3 to 5 hours. I said, okay. They just sat there, spoke to her. And bless her, the fighter that she is. A whole, like, 9 hours later, this woman is still fighting. It's just like, Mom, I know. I get why you're trying to stay here. Yeah. But it's just, you know, it's not going to be that. And so, yeah, just, I remember my sister, because we had my sister and my stepdad and my niece. And my niece was hungry. She's quite young. So my sister's like, we're going to go get her food. And I remember watching, I don't know what the machine is called, but like her heart rate just kind of consistently dipping and dipping. And it got to a point where I knew that she was going. I called my sister. I was like, Mum's going to go now. You need to come back to the hospital. So she ran back to the hospital. And I think it was within like 40 minutes. Wow. Then she had passed and just kind of stood there and said, okay. You know, I didn't think in that moment I had even begin to understand what was going to happen next.
Mm.
I was just standing in pain and this disbelief that a person who has been such a part of my life is just gone. Like, I've always had issues with kind of this no contact, cutting things off very like sterile. I need time to let go. And I got that in the sense of that I was there for the hospital for 4 weeks, but this was such a sudden, this person is breathing and now they're no longer. And it was the reason why it was so hard for me to lose my mum out of all people was because she was my person. And throughout my entire transition, my mum was the person who would call up the doctors and be like, you need to help my son, chase down all my appointments, give me my testosterone shots.
Wow.
We'd have conversations about, you know, surgery and girls at the time and, you know, navigating being a young trans person. And she was just so much more than a mum. Like, yeah. I feel like we were siblings and my sister was the mum because we were so bad together that my sister would be the one to tell us off. And so it was just losing that, as well as the mother figure, as well as your best friend, as well as your support system, as well as your basically your caregiver in many aspects. It's just like, what do you do now?
Oh, Kenny, that is really extraordinarily difficult. And I think it's interesting, isn't it? Because the thing about time, that we sometimes, when it's our situation, you know, you said, oh, I had 4 weeks, but 4 weeks is nothing. It's nothing to go from living in a different country, thinking, oh, maybe I should call her. Sounds like things aren't great. You know, probably need a good catch up, make sure she, you know, all the stuff you have when you're away from a parent or you're worrying about them, to hospitals, to intensive care, to doctors, to all of that stuff. That's, you know, your world was very fixed. And then it got turned upside down. And like you said, when you lose the person who obviously, what an amazing woman to have been so supportive, to have just obviously loved you, just pure love. Yeah. To suddenly lose that it's a lot of shock. It's a lot of shock, I guess. That's my interpretation. Because like you said, 1 minute someone's there, 1 minute they're not. And 4 weeks isn't really 4 weeks, you know?
No.
Like 4 weeks staring at a wall, watching paint dry, yeah, long. But 4 weeks watching someone you love disappear, like incrementally, like that's no time at all. You've known them 21 years. Like that's, you can't compare. I mean, what did happen afterwards? I guess like, because you were so young, your sister must have been really young as well. It's not like there was a grown up there. How did you cope?
God,
that's a big question, isn't it?
I didn't really. Yeah. That's the answer.
Yeah.
So I remember leaving the hospital. So everything's done and dusted now. You know, we've said our goodbyes. I'm like, okay, well, the only place to go is home.
Mm.
And I rode a motorcycle at the time, and I remember going downstairs, and it was about 9 a.m. in the morning. And it's in Paddington, this hospital, so St. Mary's Hospital. And so there's so many people that are going to work, like everybody's going on with their normal life. And I'm standing there thinking, none of you understand how much pain I'm in. Like, I just felt like I wasn't even there. Like, everybody's moving around me. The world is moving. I'm watching the sky and the clouds move. And I feel stuck and just pain. That's all I can feel. So I don't even remember going home.
Yeah.
I got home, I made it home, but I don't remember how I got here. I remember being at home and just sitting there and said, well, that's it. Mm. And I think at that point I had lost hope, obviously, because in the time that she was in the hospital, it was like, maybe she'll be okay.
Yeah.
Little bit that says to you, maybe she'll make it. And so when you're faced with that, and it's happened, you're sat at home, there is no hope anymore.
Mm.
So it's just the pain of it. And I have never been taught to process emotions.
Mm.
I think lots of boys and men are not taught how to process emotions. And so I didn't know what to do. And I'd never experienced this kind of loss. There were, you know, losses in my family, but nothing of nobody that was really close to me.
Yeah.
So this was my first experience with grief in itself. And I'm going to be honest, I screamed my heart out, cried my heart out to the script, and drank Jack Daniels for about 2 weeks straight. I'm not even going to lie. That's basically what happened.
You got to do what you got to do. Like, there's no right or wrong, whatever it is. And I thoroughly recommend the screaming, because I don't think people scream enough. Yeah. I think people just go, oh, I can't make that noise. But it's like, it's so visceral what's happening to you when you lose a parent. Like, you have to scream. And if you need to just get a pillow and muffle it, or out to the sky, you have to get it out. That's so much pain in you. You have to get it out.
Yeah. It was the energy aspect, because the crying wasn't enough.
Mm.
The crying felt like it relieved some of the pain, but the screaming felt like it relieved some of the anger of it all.
Yeah.
Of being a 21-year-old that's lost his mum, that now feels like he has no support system.
Mm.
Although I did, but she was the main support system.
Yeah,
she was the person who seen me the most.
Mm.
And so knowing that I've lost that in itself was one of the reasons, on top of everything else, why it was just so much more painful. And so I did that for, about 2 weeks straight. And I'm not proud of this now, but everybody was trying to contact me, obviously, and just like checking on me. And it got to a point where I said to my friends and my family, I will tell you that I'm alive, and that's what I'm saying. Because at this point, there's no conversation to be had.
Yeah.
Like, I'm broken. Let me be broken. And my friends would come and knock on my door, or like strangers, because my mum was a community worker. And so everybody knew her.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it wasn't just a loss for me, it was a loss for the community. So people wanted to come to the house, and knowing how young I was, wanted to be like, are you okay? And I remember I wrote a sign on my door saying that if you knock the door, I'll knock you out. because I was sick of everyone coming to the house. And I was just so angry.
Everyone being like, I'm just going to go and see if Kenny's all right. No, maybe we'll leave it. Let's leave it today.
Don't do it. And that probably stayed at the door for a good, like, another 2 weeks.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, it worked.
Yeah,
it
whatever worked. You got to do. Whatever you got to do. And that's the thing is, I think that's really, there's something really bold about that. Because again, when I speak to lots of people, often they'll say, what I wanted to do was put a sign on the door. Mm. But I didn't, because I can't, you can't do that. I can't do that. You can't scream and tell people to go away. But I think it sounds like you really lived your truth, like, as only you can. And I think that's amazing, because I hear so many stories of people doing the right thing, the polite thing, and then they're in so much pain, pouring tea for people they don't know and don't want to be there, and like screaming inside. I think that's way healthier for, because sometimes you need the world to just go away. Just go, give me, like you said, just give me the time. You will eventually, you know, peek your head out, but just to say, I'm not going to be civil. I'm not going to be able to make a sentence. So don't bother. Just like take your lasagnas and come back in a month. Like, I think that's really impressive.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back to Griefcast. With Carrie Adloyd.
I think, yeah, looking back on it now, it was a boundary.
Yeah,
it was a
really
boundary
clear,
of me,
yeah.
Me saying that this is what I need right now, and you're going to respect it. And if you don't respect it, although I don't want to be hitting people like that, I would have done that. It was saying how strong I was in my decision there, that, you know, if you come and you knock the door, I will knock you out. No one did, so it never happened. But
they knew. They were like, definitely, he's not joking.
Just don't do it. Just don't do it. Leave him alone. It's fine. But, you know, there was other ways, you know, after a while, people would drop me food and just make sure that I was, like, eating. Mm. And my sister would have conversations with me about the drinking. Can you drink a little bit less? Is there any other kind of coping mechanisms that you can lean on? So I'm not there yet. Like, it will happen, but I'm not there yet. And I'm not about to fight myself through something that's already very painful. Mm. Like what you're saying about doing a polite thing and basically doing things for others. I wasn't in that space. Mm. I was doing everything for me. I was taking care of me. I was my number one priority at that point. And there were so much other things that I was dealing with at that time as well that made it so much harder. Because so when she passed, obviously I had no job now.
Mm.
Because I had left, so I had no income. I barely had savings because the difference of how much I was earning there was minimal. I was left with 3 dogs because we had 3 dogs. I was left with a 2-bedroom flat that I was to pay for in London, in like quite a central location. And I was basically like being pushed out of my home at the time because they were like, you don't have enough money to take care, like pay for your bills. It was council house.
Mm.
And so they were like, you don't have enough money to be able to take care of the bills. And I don't know why the council do this. It's one of the most frustrating things. It's like, I'm going through this really bad loss, and the first thing that you think about is kicking me out and downsizing me to a 1-bedroom flat.
Oh my God. Like, yeah, just let me breathe. Like, oh my goodness.
That was literally 3 weeks in.
Oh,
and getting
for
emails
fuck's sake.
And calls. Ugh. Yeah. Being like, you know, we need you to move out of the property. And I'm saying, like, I can't even think right now. And you're asking me to move out of my house. Like, my mum's belongings are still in that bedroom. I've done nothing at this point. And so
that's outrageous.
I had to try to battle that at the time. And luckily enough, like, I know good people and they helped me through it. And for anybody listening to this, you don't have to leave your home.
Mm.
You can, as long as you can prove that you can pay the rent, it's not an issue. You don't have to downsize, but they portray it as you do.
Mm.
And my stepdad had a good job at the time. So he was like, I'll make sure that you have enough money to pay your rent until you can get a job. And so everything kind of was fine, but I was still trying to grieve. Then I was left with the three doggos and trying to take care of them. And I've never had that responsibility. I'm like, what? How am I meant to look? This is basically a whole person. Three little dogs is a whole person.
Oh my God, definitely.
Yeah. So I don't really know what to do with this, neither. And being a 21-year-old at that time and going from trying to be the man and have a career and build myself up to basically being such a small version of myself, not feeling like myself, and having my life completely like flipped upside down, having no income, like not feeling like myself, it's just so much to deal with at quite a tender age as well.
Oh my God, yeah. 21 is so young. And I think it's a tricky, isn't it? Because I, again, having spoken to so many people, often I think when you are in your early 20s, there is this like, oh, I should be a grown-up. Like, 21 is the grown-up. And it, you know, you look at 21-year-old now, you're like, you're not, you're a baby, you're baby. And I know I speak to people who are of that age, and obviously they find that offensive. And they're like, I am a grown-up. Like, you are, but also you're not. And when you're grieving, like, I think what you just said there was really interesting. You sort of become this small version of yourself because you do shrink because the world's hurt you. So you sort of shrink into this tiny version of yourself, and you... It is really hard to advocate and kind of go out and be like, no, you're not doing that to me. And that can't happen for this, because you do feel so raw, you know, like the skin's been taken off. So yeah, it's an awful lot to deal with. And I think it's really, I mean, testament to your mum, I think, that the way she taught you to look after yourself, because I love that your first instinct was like, and I think amazing that your sister said, look, can you stop drinking a bit? And you were like, no. Because I think that's really, that's a great, that she said, are there other coping mechanisms? I think, God, what a way to support someone. Say, like, I understand. I'm not saying stop drinking, you're drinking too much. I'm saying, I know this is coping. Is there another one? And you being like, not right now. Like, that's such an, those are two incredibly self-aware people. And I think a lot of what happens when people are polite or do the right thing, inverted commas, it's because they don't know what they need. So when someone else comes along and goes, oh, I'm going to come in your house and you're going to make me tea and you're going to talk to me, they think, oh, maybe that's what I need. You seem very confident. And I think that is rare that you have the ability within yourself to go, no, I'm going to drink for a bit. I'm going to listen to the script. and that's how I need to get through this. Because that first bit, it's just hell, as anyone tells you. It's hell. The first 6 months, the first year are just a blur of madness. So to be aware at least of like, okay, I know this isn't great, but I am doing it, I think is, obviously I don't advise drinking your way through grief at all. But if you can be aware of the things you're doing, you know, I'm eating this because I need, this is how I'm coping. Or I'm watching 25 hours of television. I'm on my phone 24 hours a day. But to have a slight voice in your head go, yeah, this is coping from the pain. So what was that first year? Like, do you remember much of it? Some people have just like a blank, or was it just kind of a blur? God.
It got worse.
Oh no.
It got worse. It got really bad. So 3 months after, one of my dogs died.
Oh,
and
no.
She was my childhood, my little Lulu. She was my childhood dog. And, you know, they say that doggies die from being heartbroken. And to be honest with you, in that sense, I do believe it, because those two had such a lovely relationship. Like, they were the same person. And so, it became a bit harder from that, because I was going through another grief. And in the same time that my dog died, I found out that my dad was sick.
Oh, God.
And so I was like, okay. And at this point, nobody wanted to tell me, again, what was going on, because there wasn't just Kenny's 21, but Kenny just watched his mum die.
Yeah.
And just buried his mum. And so everybody was trying to leave me out of it. But I think because I had that inkling the first time, once I seen my dad, I had the same inkling and I just knew. And all I could do in that moment was say, okay, Kenny, we're going to have to deal with this again.
Oh, God.
We're going to have to deal with this again. And I just knew. And so my dad was never sick. Like, I hadn't seen a man have a cold in my entire life. So I was just like, he's invincible, clearly. He's fine. And he did all the right things to take care of himself. So the idea that he was sick was just foreign.
Yeah.
So basically found out he had cancer.
Oh, God.
And said, okay, like, how bad is it? And all of these discussions are happening. They're like, oh, no, it's treatable. like, you know, he's going to go on to got chemotherapy. I said, okay, that's fine. And so on my dad's side, I have 11 siblings.
Wow.
So it's a large family.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there was so much discussion. And, you know, when you have that many siblings, there's always this kind of dynamic where everybody has different opinions. Mm. And, you know, you're just such different people. And I think we're all strong-headed. That's what we got from our dad. And so when he got sick, there was a conversation around how he should take care of himself. And I remember being at his house and everybody talking about, basically about him while he's lying there. And, you know, he should do chemo, he should do this, like, he should take care of himself, he should go to Jamaica because if he was going to die, that's where he wanted to die. All of these different things. And I'm sat there and I remember just feeling angry. I'd be like, he's literally there. Why is nobody asking him what he wants? Mm. And why am I, I'm the second youngest in my family.
Oh, wow.
Why am I, being the second youngest, the only person that's seeing this as an issue?
Mm.
And so I turned around and I said to my dad, I called him Papa. So I said, Papa, what do you want? And he said, I want, you know, I want to be alive. Like, I want to see all of you grow up. Like, it's not my time to go. And I said, okay, well, you do chemo. And he said, okay. And that's what all the family wanted, basically, for him. And then it came to a point where we were kind of taking turns to look after him at his house. And me and him had quite a deep conversation where I said, is it actually what you want to do? And he said, I don't want to do it. He said, I don't want to go through chemo. I don't want to do that to myself. He had seen his friends go through that process. And I just didn't want to do that for himself. And so I said to him, don't do it. You don't have to. Like, this is your life. Mm. And as much as I want you to be here for as long as you possibly can, if you don't want to do that and you would rather live out your best life while you can, I would rather you do that. And I remember, like, me and him have had quite a rocky relationship because growing up and being trans, he didn't necessarily agree in the beginning. And it was very much like stepping stones with him. And so we took time to build our relationship. I remember, like, small things, just to give context. He would always come to the house and sit on the end of my bed and just ask me how I was. And then one day, I told him I was trans. And he said, okay. Didn't really know what to do with that information. And, you know, I said to him, I'm going to change my name. I'm going to cut my hair. And he got really angry about it. He was like, I don't want you to do it. And then I did it. And he didn't really like it. And so there was, but he still stayed around and he still came and visited me. And we still tried to build our relationship. And, you know, it was clear that he loved me.
Yeah.
And he loved me fiercely and that he wanted to try. He was just grown in a different generation that wasn't accepting of trans people, but he loved me as his child. And there, you know, we took stepping stones and he stopped calling me. So my previous name was Kelsey. And so obviously my name now is Kenny. So he started calling me K as a middle ground. He then started to introduce me as his son to people. And I used to like cry silently in the corner because I was like, oh my God, he called me son. And just little things like he changed the way that he got me, like, birthday cards that said son.
Oh.
You know, just like really small things over years.
Yeah.
So we had always had that quite tough relationship, but it felt like he was the person which I really understood building a relationship with somebody, because everything came so easily with my mum.
Yeah.
My mum was just like, number one support, I love you, you're my son, fuck everybody else.
Yeah.
Whereas my dad took a while to come around. We really had to fight for the love that we had for one another and understand we both had different perspectives. And we had just gotten to a place where I feel like he fully kind of accepted me. And so to now know that he's gonna go, it was like, I felt like we just got to the point where we were friends. He wasn't just my dad, now he was my friend. And so I just said to myself, I'm gonna make the most of this. I want to have as many conversations with him as I can. And that's what I'm going to do. And so that's what I did. I went to go see him all the time. Then he moved to a hospice and he was such a donut when he was younger. So basically back in Jamaica, he had an accident while he was with a girl on a motorbike. But he shouldn't have been with the girl, basically.
Right, okay.
So I always used to laugh at him and be like, that's what happens. It's karma. And so I was like laughing with him about that. And then obviously I got into motorbikes and I love motorbikes. So we talked about our loves for that. He loved cars. We spoke about our love for cars. He got really deep at one moment and started to talk about how proud he was and that he was sorry that he wasn't there in a way that he should have been.
Oh.
And that he should have tried a lot sooner to kind of be there in the way that he was now. And it was just like, I'm proud of you. Like out of I think out of all of my siblings, not to say that they haven't gone through things, obviously everybody does, but he said that I feel like you've kind of had a lot of more obstacles to deal with in your life. And to be at, because I think I was 22 at this point, to be 22 and be so strong in who you are and fight for yourself and just, you know, be happy, like, that takes a lot. And so, yeah, we just had lots of those kind of conversations. And I went to the hospice one day and it wasn't him anymore. It wasn't him. He was half there, halfway out, and I knew it. And I didn't feel like I could watch him go, because watching my mum. So I decided to leave. This was at 6 p.m. I get a call at 8 p.m. saying he's gone.
Wow.
So that happened. And it just, I think at that moment, it wasn't just, it was thinking about all the things that I'm going to lose. Like, I'm never going to have my parents there if I ever get married. I'm not going to know certain parts of my upbringing because my parents aren't there to ask. And so there were so many different aspects of myself that I started to feel like I was losing. Mm. And so, again, kind of losing my identity, because you lose yourself in the grief.
Yeah.
And then I'm literally losing answers to my life, because I'm not going to have them, because the people that I should be asking aren't here.
Mm.
And so it just, that year felt like losing myself, grappling onto things, having conversations with my sister and my other siblings, and asking, you know, how was dad when he was this age, or how was I at this age, and them trying to make sense of things for me, because I had so many questions now that I knew I wasn't going to have answers to. And it just felt like, just like everything was happening too much, and too much was happening at the same time, and just like just a lot. And I was trying to have a normal life, so to speak, trying to go out and spend time with friends and get another job and rebuild myself, while I'm in the most painful experience that could probably happen to someone of that age.
Bloody hell. So, like, yeah, that is such a lot. I think what you said there is really, really interesting about grief and identity, which I've thought before, but I think the way you're describing it is so brilliant. That you know, when you lose a parent, you, like you said, you lose all these answers. And I completely relate to that, obviously, losing my dad at 15. Mm. Like, all these things that, you know, every year you're like, oh, I wonder what they did then. Like, all these new questions. You know, you can only ask the questions you have at the time. And when you're young, obviously, your set of questions is quite specific. And then when you get older, you think, why did I ask them that? Like, I should have been asking about this. Way more interesting. But, you know, you've only got what you've got at the time. And when someone dies, you shatter. You know, you really shatter. Mm. And you're having to rebuild yourself. And then, you know, for you just to be on that process of like, okay, I've lost my mum, how can I rebuild myself? To lose your dad, and it is a complete, a strange kind of obliteration that you have to then find all these pieces of yourself that are everywhere, you know, and get them back. And I think, you know, like what your dad said about you, I think is really true, because at 22, to have that clear sense of like, this is who I am, this is what I need, this is who I am, this is what I need from other people, that is so rare. Like, that is really rare. I think people take their lives to think who they are, what they want, what they don't like. Like, people go for years eating things they don't like because they just don't know. And then they're like, I actually don't even like this food or this person or this town. So I think, yeah, I mean, that is, you know, that is such a lot to deal with, is what to say. But yeah, I think that idea of grief and identity is really interesting. And especially, I think, when you have a strong sense of who you are anyway, that's what I'm trying to say. Mm. So if you have a strong sense of who you are, and you kind of, you know, you've already got that, and then the world is always trying to disagree with you, because that's what the world does.
Mm.
And then grief smashes you apart. You know, you sort of have to go, oh, maybe the world's right. Like, is this who I am? What am I doing? What, like, it's really, really hard. And to lose two parents, I think what you're hitting on it, from the, obviously my mum's still here, but the people I speak to who are, you know, for a better word, in the orphan club, it's like all those doors are closed, you know, all those doors are closed. And that's why, yeah, thank God, if you have siblings or you have family you can still talk to, like, that is so precious. And I tried to explain that before to people, like, if I find a photo of him As a girl, I'm like, oh, it's gold. Everything is gold dust. You know, it's gold dust. You're like, oh my God, he's seven there. Like, what's he doing? Where was he? What happened? Oh my, because it's just these bits that you don't get to say to someone.
You discover them as well. It's weird. I remember finding, my mum used to do like cross stitching.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And so she made this particular one for my dad, and basically it was like a map of Jamaica and some of his like favorite like political people.
Yeah.
And I was like, when did she make this for him? And why? Because I only found it when my dad passed and we went through his belongings.
Yeah, yeah.
And everyone was like, this must have been your mum, Kenny. I was like, oh my God, it is. What is this? When did she make this? This is incredible. I need to hang this up. This is mine. And because we were all kind of claiming stuff, which was going to be who's and who's. I was like, yeah. But I think as well, with grief and identity and all those things, like so much changes. And it's only now that I'm realizing how much of me changed. And like really quite weird things.
Mm.
Like my attachment style. I don't know if you read the book Attached.
I haven't, but I'm aware of attachment styles. But please, say more. Yeah. I'm sure I don't know as much as you.
So there's, in this book, it talks about there being three attachment styles. Yes. So anxious, avoidant, secure.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And prior to my mum passing, I was secure.
Mm.
Like I was so confident in who I was. I wasn't really somebody who got like jealous or any of those things. And I was confident to love with my whole heart. What I found when my mum died and then after my dad dying and getting into relationships was that I just wasn't able to give my heart away in the same way because I was so scared of my heart being anywhere near that hurt again.
Yeah.
And so for years, I think it was only with my last partner that I really tried to let myself actually like feel things full-heartedly because it just felt impossible. And so grief takes so many little different parts of you sometimes. And even my like level of optimism towards the world and thinking, you know, being that 21 year old before those things happened, be like, I can do everything, you know. Do you know what I mean? You just feel, I don't know, I'm very passionate and I'm very like business minded. And I was like, I can do anything I want to do. But losing that support system that was so dear to me made me think, well, I could do that and I can do that. But my mental health started to suffer more because I didn't have that one person, specifically my mom, who I felt like seen all parts of me, every single side of me, and loved me regardless and accepted me regardless, good and bad. And I seen the same in her. Like I said, I didn't really feel like I started to grieve until year five. And it just, that's really when I would say I started to rediscover myself. Like the rest of it was just getting through it.
Yeah.
Honestly, getting through it.
Yeah.
Just surviving. And, you know, I started to get to a point where my career really started to boom. And I fronted a period campaign and made history of it by doing that. And the only person I wanted to tell was my mum.
Yeah.
You know, you want to go to them for the achievements. And when shit hit the fan, the only person I wanted to talk to was her. And so I had to find ways to cope. Like I would go basically outside the hospital. There is this like nice little waterfront bit. And I would sit there and I just talk to her. And I'd be like, mum, I did this campaign. You'll laugh because it was about periods. And you know how moody I was when I had a period. And I would say, like, I miss you. How are you? The doggos are okay. I know you're with Lulu now. I know you're taking care of her. And, like, literally, I used to put my headphones in because I didn't want people thinking that, you know, I was crazy. But I was literally talking out loud. And, you know, sometimes I would go there and I would just cry and I would bring her favourite drink and I would drink mine. And I always do it, like, I'm created like a grief ritual where I would always do it next to water. I don't know, something for me and being next to water just felt so, like, I felt more connected to her.
Mm.
You know, it's hard. Like, I still have her bed.
Mm.
And that's a really weird thing. Like, I got rid of, and this dollhouse that you can see, and nobody else is going to see it, but this dollhouse is in the background. She built it.
Oh, wow.
And this certain thing, yeah, it's, I'll show you after, give you the tour, but yeah, it's incredible. She built everything inside of it. She's got, like, mini family photos and everything.
Oh, my God.
But I think, yeah, you start to hold on to things in different ways and you start to make peace with things.
I feel like it's funny, isn't it? Because you're very privileged to have a parent that loves you. And you're one is very privileged.
Yeah.
And and that's a really great thing. But when they go, it makes the world so wobbly. And I used to describe it as like you're at the deep end. You know, you go to put your foot down and you're like, whoa, where's the bottom? Like,
where's the rest of
yeah,
it?
Yeah, like, hang on a minute. I thought, because that level of support that you've grown up with or you're used to just disappearing, it is really shaky. And But the good thing about it, from my experience, is that if you know they loved you, it doesn't stop the grief being, it doesn't make the grief easy. It doesn't, you know, grief, there's no easy route with grief. But I think when you come through it a bit, at the light at the end is, I do know I was loved. And I think that is really helpful. And obviously, if you're listening to this and you didn't feel like that, like, I'm not saying things are better or worse. It's just, I found it helpful to come out of it and feel like, okay, despite all the complications and all the sadness, like, I feel like I do know I was loved. And that can kind of start to rebuild your floor a bit, I guess, when you're trying to put your feet down. And obviously they loved you so much. Like, you can just tell, it just like beams out of you, which is like credit to, you know, both of them. But obviously your mum, who just didn't let you for a second think you weren't important and you weren't loved, which is, what else can you do for a child? I think that's
it. Do you know what? That's what it is. It's, you know, it's as hard as it was, I'm very grateful. Mm. You know, I know some people don't get to meet their parents. Yeah. I know some people have parents that don't love them fiercely. And so as much as it was hard and, you know, I wish I had more time, who doesn't wish that?
Yeah.
And I just sit here and I go, do you know what? Like, she was, I feel like as well, because she was such an incredible one in like so many different ways, even having those 21 years of her will carry me for 70 years, if that makes sense. Yeah, it's just, she instilled so many good values in me, and she showed me in so many ways, especially as being a trans person navigating today's society. She was like, you are loved. Like, and if nobody else loves you, I love you. And do you know what I mean? And you love you.
Yeah.
And being like, having that little bubble and just knowing that, even when she left, although it was hard and I was broken, and to some degree I still am, I'm good. You know, I love me. She loves me. And so I'm able to carry that even today, even though the last time we hugged or spoke actual words to one another was nearly 7 years ago. Like, she still feels so present in my life in the sense. And I do things purposely now to hold on to her a little bit more, like I have I digged out some newer pictures that I haven't had, and I rotate through different pictures as the years go on, and, you know, I find ways to keep her memory alive. And, you know, as a writer, I write about her a little bit more, and I think finding ways to keep her alive in spirit, and, you know, people, and just keeping her here with me as many in whatever way is possible is also important, because I think that's what helps me. That's what helps me get through it all. So, yeah, it's... But like you said, grief is just... I think it's probably one of the most, like, unexplainable emotions to go through. It's so hard to find the words. And there's no perfect way of dealing with it. And so much of your life will change. But you know what? I wouldn't be Kenny if it wasn't for that. Do you know what I mean? I don't even think I would be an advocate if it wasn't for what I experienced, because I generally don't believe I would have had tough enough skin to be able to deal with what I'm dealing with today if it wasn't for that experience. Yeah. Like, it breaks you, but then you pick up those pieces and you go, I'm a soldier now. And I just think that once you've experienced that kind of loss, it's like, whatever else happens to me. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
This is a walk in the park. Yeah. And it's sad to say that it shouldn't be that, but there's something about that, losing something that's so important to you, losing that somebody that's so important to you, that just makes you go, fuck it. I think in moments it's about trying to find the beauty within the pain of it all. Because if you just sit in the pain, there's no fun in that.
Kenny, thank you so much. You have spoken just so beautifully about it. And I completely forgot, which I normally do, to ask their names at the beginning. So what was your mum's name?
Edwina, and my dad's name was Lloyd.
Edwina and Lloyd. Oh, well, I appreciate Lloyd, obviously. What a guy. Thank you so much. It was just so, so lovely to talk to you. And I think, I completely agree. You know, these things are awful, but some beauty weirdly comes out of them, and that's all you can have. And just thank you for talking to me today about Edwina and Lloyd. I really appreciate it.
Listen, I've had such a great time. It's nice to be able to talk about them. So thank you for having me.
You can follow Kenny on Instagram at Kenny Ethan Jones. That's Kenny, Kennyethanjones, J-O-N-E-S. NES. You can follow us at Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast. The show was recorded remotely. It was edited by Kate Holland, music by The Glue Ensemble, artwork by Jade Perkin. And remember, you are not alone.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.